This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Lexington, Kentucky studio, and I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219 XM 206, and to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. On average, 2 riders are permanently disabled every year in the U.S. The PDJF is a nonprofit charity that provides much-needed assistance to disabled riders who have given everything to the sport. If you're able to help, please visit the website www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening made history in 2000 when he became the first African-American jockey to ride in the Breeders' Cup and the first to ride in the Kentucky Derby in 79 years. He's been leading rider at Delta Downs, Lone Star, and Kentucky Downs, and he's still going strong with 2,398 wins and over $44 million in earnings. Marlon St. Julien, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Marlon, so great to have you here on the show. I know you're very busy, especially this time of year with Churchill going on. Really appreciate you taking the time to do this, Marlon, and catch our audience up on what you're doing now.
Well, actually, I'm in Kentucky. I stayed here this past winter to try to get things going or whatever again. I want to get established here again, and it's starting to work out. You know, I've been working my tail off, and I've had a big supporter, Javier Alvarado. I stay at his farm, and he's been helping me out. And I got this new agent, Robert O'Connor's the trainer, his son. And things are starting to work out for me. You know, I've got to get the confidence in people again because, you know, I messed that up years ago, and it's starting to work out.
Well, that's awesome, Marlon. And tell us, why Kentucky?
Because I love Kentucky. I mean, you know, I'm from Louisiana, and and it's not just because a couple of, like, the Cajun riders have resided here, but I did have a home here. Me and my wife, we divorced now. It's my ex-wife, but, I mean, it's an awesome place to live. It's the heart of horse racing to me. It's just, I can go on and on with the positive things as far as Kentucky, you know. It to me, is a place to be. I mean, I'm not trying to knock anywhere else because, you know, there's a lot of places in this country that I like, and as far as business-wise, there's a lot of places that I like, but, I mean, as far as all-around living, I like Kentucky. It suits me fine.
Marlon, I got to say, I agree with you. Maybe I'm a little bit biased because I live here, but I love Kentucky. It is definitely the place to be if you're involved in horse racing whatsoever. And success here with everything's going on here in Kentucky, Churchill, Keeneland coming up. You're Marlon, but tell us, you said, as you mentioned, you're from Louisiana as so many riders we've had here on the show, so many successful top riders in the sport are from Louisiana. What is it about that great state that just brings about so many good jockeys?
Must be something in the water, something in the bayou.
Something?
I mean, I don't know. It's just, you know, the way we come up, you know. You know, I'm from Lafayette. I'm not from, say, Calvin Burrell's from I think he's from Catahoula. A lot of the other guys are from like the DeLevy and Henderson. I mean, it's the way we come up is I was in Lafayette, which is kind of like more city than country, but we live in the city, but we still do country things, and then we go with our grandparents and we around horses and all kind of animals. It's just, I don't know, it's just in our nature. It's something that we bred into, you know. I mean, and it's not just horse racing. I know you have farm living everywhere, but it's not Cajun style. You can't top that.
Not Cajun style. Marlon, we had Calvin Burrell on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he was awesome, yeah. Of course. And he talked about the bush tracks. Did you participate in that as well?
You know, I did, but honestly, not as many as say Calvin Burrell and Shane Sellers and the guys like that. No, I rode. Let me see, maybe six races on the bush track. You know, when I was always interested in being a jockey because I come up around a racetrack. My mom was always at the racetrack. My family had race horses, and it's like it's just I don't know. I can't explain it. I can't put it into words. It's just something that how can I say that? Am I answering the question right?
Yes, you are. Keep going, please.
you get me. So my mind went way the other way as far as something else that came up when you said Calvin Burrell. Well, what was your question again? I'm sorry.
No, I was asking about the bush tracks.
And the bush tracks, okay. I only rode like between five and six races at the bush track because when I really decided that I wanted to become a jockey, this is weird because I was in high school. And I was playing football. I played football my freshman and sophomore year. And believe it or not, I weighed 129 pounds, 130 pounds, something like that, you know, which is way over jockey weight.
Right.
And my mom didn't want me to become a jockey because she witnessed a bunch of accidents or spills or whatever, you know, we'd call it. And I always had trouble with that. But my uncles would always, when I would go away with them to the barn, to our barn, the farm that we had, you know, I started galloping horses, and I did that kind of under the hat. So it was hard for me to go to the bush tracks a lot because my mom didn't want me to become a jockey. You know, I did good in school, and my plan was, especially with them, was to go on to college, and I wanted to be major in, like, become an electrical engineer or whatever. Not. So I had to sneak away and ride the bush track races, honestly. You know, it's not like some of the jocks, like Calvin and them, had to ride bush track races. Their parents made them. Well, mine didn't want me to. You know, it's just the passion and the love for wanting to become a jockey that made me do that, and I had to hide it. You know, honestly, my mom and my dad, they've been divorced. They were divorced since I was like 10. And I remember when I first started playing football, my dad bought me all kind of vitamins, amino acids, and books and stuff like that. And I was lifting weights. I wanted to become big. And then the next year, you know, I would talk to him all the time, but I would miss going like on the weekends, you know. And it's like he went a whole like 6-7 months, and then all of a sudden, I had to call him and tell him, Dad, I rode a race today at Evangeline Downs. I said, what? He said, you better come and see me, because he wanted to see if I lost weight, and I did. And I lost like 20 pounds before I even rode. So, I mean, I'm kind of telling you the story in bits and pieces, but it's, you know, we had a lot of time. I'd really tell you the whole story. It's amazing. I think I'm going to write a book about myself.
I tell you what, just from what I've heard so far, you definitely should, Marlon. I mean, that's a huge difference to go from wanting to play football and then wanting to go to school to become an electrical engineer. And then all of a sudden, oh, guess what? I rode a race today.
I know. You know, it's like I had it in my mind at the time that I'm going to be too big to be like Eddie Delahousie or man, Chris Antley was like, or Lafitte Pincai or Angel Cordero. Angel Cordero was like my man, you know, and I'm going to be too big for that. And then I'm going to be too small to be a professional football player because, you know, I was always the smaller guy, shorter guy. I played like running back, flanker, and receiver in football, but I was smaller, but I was tough, you know. And my idol was this running back for the New York Giants. His name was Joe Morris, number 20 around that time. And he was my idol because he was small, and that's who I wanted to be like. So it was like a conflict in my mind. You're going to play football or you're going to become a jockey or you're going to go to college. What are you going to do? You know, it was mixed up. And when I realized that I could lose the weight and become that. That was it, you know? That was it.
Marlon, I think you made the right decision. But how did you lose the weight? I mean, I completely understand. I'm tall and I rode, and it's very, very tough. But how did you lose the weight even before you started?
I know. It's so hard. And it's sad to say, you know, there was this guy that he worked for my uncles that had the racehorses, and he was an ex-rider or whatever, and, you know, and I told him that, you know, whenever he realized I wanted to become a jock, he said, well, I can get you to lose the weight, you know, that can help you, you know, you, And which the right proper thing is to exercise and sweat it off or whatever, and diet or whatever. And I did all of that, but I also started regurgitating my food.
Yeah.
And that's how I, you know, it's not a safe and healthy thing to do, but that's what I did, you know. And I did that for, like, I played football going into my senior year, my junior year of high school. No, my freshman and sophomore year. And the summer of my junior year is when I lost all the weight. Yeah, the wintertime and this whatever, before the summertime. And in the summertime of my junior year is when I started riding.
Wow.
And then I froze my apprenticeship, and then I had to go back to school. So, but it was like to answer your question, I lost the weight, but I used to run a lot with a plastic suit and stuff, but I also, you know, which I hid that from everyone for a couple of years, regurgitating my food, you know. And I'm not proud to say that because it's not, you know, and I've come a lot better. I do it, but not hardly, you know, and I do maintain my weight by watching what I eat and stuff like that. But that's how I did it at first. You know, I lost 27 pounds before I ever rode.
Marlon, no, and that's, you know, and that's one of the tough things about the industry. I did the same thing. It's not easy when you're struggling every single day and all you can think about is how hungry you are, and it's a really, really tough thing. But I'm so glad to hear that, you know, now that you're riding regularly, and of course you're busy, and it's easier to keep the weight off as long as you know you ride consistently, and that's great to hear.
Sure.
That, you know,
and I tell you what, besides exercising, we stay so busy at Robbie's farm. I mean, I worked myself to death. I'm going to say it. He works me to death, this guy. So if I have trouble losing weight, I don't know, because I might be Alvarado's form.
he's keeping you in shape, it sounds like.
Oh, my God. We stay busy over here. It's always something that we can do. I mean, you have a form. I mean, it's always something that needs to be fixed or something to be done. It never stops, you know. And I like doing stuff like that because we come up like that and, you know, it was pretty much his dream to have a place like this. And I mean, mine, too. It's not mine, but it's like mine at the same time, you know. And he's like, I mean, he just put me in the mix like he was nothing, you know. And I love him for that. So, anyway, go ahead.
You guys are close, obviously. Now when starting to ride, did you guys ride together there in the beginning as well?
Yeah, I started a year before him. We went to school together. He stayed, I stayed in Lafayette. He stayed in kind of like Brobridge, but we were like, probably 6 miles down the road from each other. But anyway, when I first started, I started, you know, like I said, I only rode the summertime, and I was still back and forth home. But the year after that, when he started, we stayed together, and, we stayed together probably the first 4 or 5 years of our career. Yeah.
Who do you credit to teaching you how to ride?
Who do I credit? This guy, he's passed. His name is was Lee Allen. He's the guy that actually taught me how to heave, and he taught me how to gallop. And also my uncle, my mom's brother, he took the time to let me get on the horses and stuff like that. It's three uncles that had horses. It was pretty much a hobby, not like a the main business, you know what I mean? They only had a few horses here and there the other years, but he would take the time, you know. I would on the weekends, I would go with him to the barn, and you know, what he knew from being around the racetrack a lot, he, you know, put me on the old mare and let me, you know, taught me how to get, you know. He didn't know much about the job part, but just what he knew as far as that, because he never did gallop, but he knew enough to get me started. And then when the guy started working for them, he finished that off. And that's, the credit goes to my uncle Mark and poor Lee Allen Felix. He's passed. Yeah.
Did it feel natural when you first started to ride, and was it easy for you? You were already an athlete. Was it easy to catch on?
I tell you what, I'm blessed because everything came pretty much natural to me. I mean, because I never had any trouble. I was always, even when I first, I mean, the first week or two of my career, when I was licensed as a professional jockey, I was complimented on my style and the way I looked on the horse, and I never tried to do so. You know, there I could see jobs that they, you know, they need to get polished up or whatever. But I, from the start, I just had it, you know, and a lot of some Louisiana are like that. I don't know why, but I really can't answer that question to tell you the truth. But yeah, it became natural. You know, I think it's a blessing that I took advantage of, I took advantage of it in a bad way sometimes. You know, I'm kind of making up for that now.
Well, like you said, Marlon, there must be something in the water there in Louisiana for sure. Well, how would you describe your riding style?
Well, I think I'm versatile. You go places and people stereotype you. You get out the gates, you're a speed rider, or you got good hands, you can relax well, but I think I'm all around, with whatever situation that is at play, I can do, but I was known for my looks on the horse and my aggressiveness. I guess that's pretty much like what people would say that especially the jockeys more than the public or the trainers too. Like, I'm really aggressive. And I remember when Randy took me, and he would tell me all that. Randy Romero was my agent, and when he retired, and he's like, man, you look so good, but man, you're so aggressive, so strong, man. Whew, if I was that strong, man, you know how dangerous I would have been? Like that. And, people were complimenting. I'm getting older, but I still got the aggressiveness. Those young kids, they can't get over me yet. It's just, right. As a lot of young riders, and it's just, it's harder to get back in, especially, maybe we'll talk about that later. The things that I did, which were no-nos, it kind of put a cap on, me rising to the top. But, that's what I'm known for, pretty much, my aggressiveness.
Would you say that playing football in high school helped you be strong as a rider?
It's possible because, when I was lifting weights a lot, working out a lot, and I had a lot of muscle. If I could show you a picture, you wouldn't believe it was me. It looked like a little Mighty Mouse. and your bones get stronger too. And maybe that might have had I don't know. But I'm aggressive with everything that I do when I'm, playing football. And I got to watch myself with everything, especially any type of sport. I'm real aggressive, That's just in me, And as far as, on a horse, especially if a horse is running, and whether you're winning or not, but if your horse is really, giving it his all, and he's an average to above, above that horse, and he's really running, it's a high that I get. I can't explain it, and it's like I want to just pick him up, and just if he's not going fast enough to win, I just want to carry. I can't explain it. It's a high that I get. But to answer your question, maybe football did. I don't know, but it would have been in me anyway to be like that,
Marlon, you're describing the feeling of being on a 1,000-pound animal and just feeling that. Power and the muscle, and it's giving me goosebumps.
You know that feeling.
Oh, my God. It's the best feeling in the world. It's the best feeling in the world. Jockey Marlon St. Julian joining me on Jock Talk tonight, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And, Marlon, you started your career out of Angeline, and you quickly took off. However, you had a nasty spill pretty early on in your career. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I sure did. It was actually the second week of my career, and I was on a first-time starter. The name of the horse was La Tigris, L-A, then capital T-I-G-R-E-S-S, something like that. And we're going a mile, which is, two turns over there, and going into the first turn, I broke out of the four-hole or whatever, and going into the first turn, instead of switching leads and dropping over and making the bend like every other horse, well, my horse decided to bolt. And I ended up catching a horse's heel that was in the front of me. And I think like four horses went down, three of them, they trampled over me. I know that. I remember the horse trying to bolt. And I remember going into this, the horse in the front of me, his rear end. And that's all I remember. I know I clipped heels after, but I got knocked out. And I had coming out of that, I had a couple cracked ribs. I had a ruptured spleen. I had a laceration on my liver. you know, a couple bumps and bruises and scratches all over his head to get stitches in my chin. But it was, I guess, pretty bad. You know, I was very fortunate. And, you know, I said to myself, you know, that was the summer of my junior year. And when I fell, man, I'm like, and I remember in the emergency room, my parents was there, and my uncles came in there. And, man, I'm going to college. I'm not doing this. And at the time, the television was on in there, and for an hour or so after that, what came on was, at the time it was called Thoroughbred Digest on ESPN. Mm-hmm. My uncle had it on ESPN, my mom, somebody had it on ESPN, and that came on, and I started watching the horse race, and I said, shit, I'm going back, and after that, I did. I stayed out of, I was out for like probably 2 months, I think it was. And I ended up riding the latter part of the Evander Downs meet, and I froze my apprenticeship and went, you know, back to school. But I remember taking, it was the beginning, it was, the school hadn't, the end of school was not yet done. And I remember taking all my my final exams at home. I was on homebound the latter part of my school year, my junior year. And it was a rough time, but I made it through that. And I've been very, very fortunate throughout the 26 years I've been riding. And I broke my leg last year on a horse one morning at Indiana Downs. But that, I've been very fortunate as far as spill wise. I've been in a lot of spills, but, you know, God's been watching over me. I never really got hurt bad, except that first one was the worst.
Wow. Thank goodness. But they couldn't keep you away, Marlon.
They couldn't
keep you away. You mentioned a couple times that you froze your apprenticeship, which is, of course, mm-hmm. the weight allowance that riders get when they're just starting out. And you went back to school to finish out high school. Now, I know some riders, they would just drop out and just go ride. Why was it important for you to finish school?
Well, I'm not bragging, but I always did good in school. My mom was a teacher. I mean, she taught Head Start in kindergarten, but she still was in the school system, and it was over her dead body that I was going to quit school. And I if I wanted to, which it thought, you know, when I started winning races and making money, I thought about it, but I'm like, she wasn't going to let me. So, I'm glad I did that, you know, got that out of the way. But, when I started making money, I thought about it, and she said, I was kind of trying to bring it up in the conversation, and I was also, you know, that was one of the days I got paid. I think I made maybe $1,100 or whatever, which was super, super a lot for me. You know, I'm in high school and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, and we're talking to my dad, and mom, you know, I'm like, you know, what if I just, don't even think about it. Don't even think about it. Nope, you're going to graduate in case something happens. And that's what I did. Yeah, when I after the summer meet was over, when I went after the injury, I went back. You know, I rode the latter part of the meet at Evander Downs, and I froze my bug. You know, froze it. So you know, the time went on, and after I came back, I started it again. After I graduated from high school, I started it again.
Well, your mother sounds like a very wise woman.
Oh yes, she is. I respect my parents a whole lot.
Very good decision. Now you said also she was a little bit apprehensive about letting you ride. Has she since, you know, been there to watch you ride, maybe in some of the big races you've participated in?
Oh, yeah. She was, when I first started, she was always there, no doubt. But she, you know, she wouldn't watch the race like you know, everyone standing and watching the monitor or television at the time. And, I mean, if I was in the race, she would tell me that she would put her head down or whatever. But she would listen, you know, and then would watch it out, you know, watch the replays or something like that. Or go and come in the picture if I would win, but she was just scared for me, you know what I mean? That's all the mother's worry, but she knew that was deep down in my heart, that's what I wanted to do, and she wasn't going to stop me, you know. And my dad, I kind of hid it from him because he was, you know, so into, you know, he had bought me a little car my senior year, and I was playing, you know, well, my junior year, and I was playing football, and he was helping out with that. But, I mean, my dad's always been supportive, you know what I mean? But I kind of hid it from him because I was, at the time, I didn't know how he was going to, you know, respond to that, you know, me becoming a jockey, you know, because we had, you know, this parent taught my mom, like I said, they were divorced since I was like 10, 11. And, you know, on both sides, you know, talked about it, you know, I was doing good at school. I was always on honor roll. Prince was on honor roll a couple of times, and I was going to college, and that's what they had in their mind, you know. But then my mom saw the transformation. But then my dad saw it after the fact, you know. But, I mean, yeah, that's what happened.
Wow. So Marlon, so you you froze your apprenticeship, you finished school, and then after you finished school, you came back. And take us through your career from there, as far as happened.
I went there, and I started back at Evangeline Downs after I graduated, and I rode there, Evangeline Downs and Delta, and I always did good, like really good. But I never, you know, it's not that I never made like super a bunch of riding titles or whatever. Not, I rode Delta Downs and Evangeline Downs for the first maybe 6-7 years of my career, and I wanted to step up a little bit. I started going to Shreveport and Louisiana Downs and Fairgrounds. That was the next step up for us Louisiana guys. And after I ended up going to the Fairgrounds the first year. First year I went there, and I did pretty good. That same year, this racetrack that was opening was Lone Star Park in Dallas, Grand Prairie, Texas, near Dallas, Texas. And the agent that I had at the time, which is Richard Price, Miguel Mendez's agent right now. Anyway, he said, man, we ought to try going there, you know. And I had never been out of the state, period. You know, I mean, back and forth maybe to Houston or whatever, but just to go somewhere and stay and be based there, you know, I went. So anyway, in 97, I ended up going there. And, poor, that was like the jump start of my career. You know, I went there and I won the first race ever run there. And that year, they had it in two categories for some reason, but I made leading rider by money earned, and second by wins to Ronald Ordoin, who was the king in Louisiana, you know, at the time, and he ended up coming to the new track too. And I finished second by wins with him, but beat him in money earned. And then the next year, I blew away with it, you know, and I made leading rider both sides. And after that, I ended up going to Chicago. This agent, Harry the Hat, called me after, it was the second year? Yeah, the second year. After 2 years of being in Dallas, I ended up going to Chicago. You know, he kept calling me and saw how good I was doing. He said, man, you ever thought about coming to Chicago? I said, hell yeah. You know, Kurt Bork rode there. He left Louisiana. He did good. And Kurt Bork's one of my idols at all time. I mean, he was a Louisiana rider, but my God, that's another story in itself. But anyway, I end up leaving Lone Star, and then I went to Chicago and did pretty good, you know. I remember I was third leading rider, and the agent that I had at the time, Harry Hatt, he was like, he's had all kind of Hall of Fame riders. But anyway, he thought they were giving me problems because I got dazed several times for like little or nothing, and I was third leading rider, and I think I was gaining on Mark Guidry pretty good. He was a leading rider, we ended up leaving before that meet was over, and I left and got ready, went to the Fairgrounds early or whatever or not. So it's kind of cloudy what I'm telling you. I'm thinking about it, and I think I'm telling it right. So anyway, I went to, I left there, and in between that time, Randy Romero started calling me. He's like, you know, Marlon, you know, I'm about to retire. He said, man, I'd like to be agent. You need to come to Kentucky. And, you know, I'm like, really, you want to take me? Like, I couldn't believe it, you know. And that's what ended up happening. The year I went with Harry, they had Harry end up leaving. We were doing pretty good, but he had to go back to Chicago for some personal deal. And I ended up getting Randy, and things just blew up from there. I finished the Fairgrounds meet with Randy. That was in 98-99. I finished the Fairgrounds meet with Randy, and we went on to Kentucky from the Fairgrounds. And it was, you know, pretty good from there. You know, I make a long story short, I ended up, I went to Kentucky, and it was like, I'm amazed or whatever. And I started doing good. I had guys like Kenny McPeak, Pat Byrne, and people like that behind Randy, and they gave me Dallas Stewart. They gave me shots, you know,
Marlon,
out of the world. And,
let me stop you right there. We'll continue talking about Kentucky after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi. Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Pena, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network. But the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Emma Jestic starting to pick her way through the pack as they're just outside the quarter pole, three quarters in one, 10 and two, and they're on their way home. And Fioretti turns first. Fioretti trying to run on and hold off Innovative Idea, who switches to the outside. All Chocolate has a lot of work to do, and Emma Jestic needs a seam. Less than an eighth of a mile to go. Innovative Idea found the front. Here's Emma Jestic with a sustained Medicine Rally deep stretch. Innovative Idea well off the rail. Emma Jestic running on. Innovative Idea and Marlon St. Julian wins the 35th running of the Grade 3 Groupie Doll in 1:36.1.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joined tonight by jockey Marlon St. Julian. And we just heard the replay of the Grade 3 Groupie Doll Stakes, Marlon's victory aboard Innovative Idea this year, actually. And Marlon, we're going to speak about that victory and how it was especially important to you, but we'll get to that in a little bit. Okay. What I'd like to do right now, Marlon, is start where we left off before going to the commercial break. And you mentioned Randy Romero, of course, the great Randy. We've had him on the show here, too. And he was your agent, and you two decided to head to Kentucky.
Yes, we did. And, you know, actually when it got officialized, Randy was still riding in Kentucky. How did that go? I remember he was here and I was in Louisiana, and he, Robbie called me. He said, man, you see your little agent working for you already. He said, he takes his hat, his helmet off, he puts his hat on, and he's hustling mounts for you already. And I remember before I moved out here in Kentucky, he flew me there. I was on a horse for Al Stahl and another horse for Scooter Dickey. And I ran second on the horse for Al Stahl, and I won the race for Scooter Dickey. And that was the first one I had in Kentucky. And he's like, man, I cried like a little baby. But anyway, yeah, Randy retired, and he took me in. When I ended up coming here, I had shots from, you know, the guys I couldn't believe it, you know. I mean, like Pat Byrne, you know, and Kenny McPeak, Dallas Stewart. I mean, guys that they just, you know, I guess, you know, heard about me through Randy and maybe, you know, through my success at Lone Star. But, you know, he's a Hall of Fame rider, and he, you know, had friends and made them pay attention to me. And, you know, I got going really quick, you know, quicker than I would ever anticipate in Kentucky. And it was awesome. And in 2000, I ended up riding the Breeders' Cup for Dallas Stewart, and I rode the Derby that year. And I mean, it was awesome. And I did good the first few years in Kentucky, and then things kind of went down a little bit. You know, Randy got sick, and, you know, he had cirrhosis of the liver, he's got, and he actually at the time, right now, he does that Dallas twice a week or whatever. But anyway, when he got sick, things kind of, you know, fell off for me. And and I hate to say it, but I started experimenting with drugs and you know, I bought a home in Kentucky and things were just like going super fast for me. And I did some things that I regret now, you know what I mean? But, and it took a toll on me and my business fell and I ended up having to leave Kentucky and me and my ex-wife split up. We ended up divorcing and, I left Kentucky and I ended up going to Chicago. Penny, this agent, Penny Fitchage, this lady from England, which used to be a Kentucky agent. She said, you need to come up here, Marlon, to Chicago. So I filed bankruptcy in the state of Kentucky and ended up going, and I'm going to, back to Chicago and, you know, did pretty good or whatever. And, actually I was third lead rider again. I was at Arlington and I ended up leaving because I wanted to see what was so green on the other side of the fence as far as my ex-wife. She had left and went to Louisiana with my kids. And, you know, I ended up leaving Chicago and going back to Louisiana and stayed there for 5-6 years. And, I ended up coming back to Kentucky after, you know, I did several things happened in between that time, the time I was in Louisiana, good and bad, but, you know, mostly good. And I got an offer to go back to Kentucky from, well, actually Indiana. So Brett Calhoun said I could ride everything for him in Indiana. And my plan was to go to Kentucky, but I ended up going there first to Indiana. And I rode there, the last 4 years. And now this year I came back to Kentucky.
Well, Marlon, I can tell you should definitely start working on writing that book because you have you've just told us, you know, the highs and lows of the sport, everything that's involved as far as you rode in the Derby and you experienced the lows after that. And it's just so, so great to see how you're just still, you know, you're still going strong and you've conquered all of that and you're doing well now. And Marlon, I got to say, I really want to talk about those highs, the Derby, the Breeders' Cup, and of course the fact that, you know, you were the first African American jockey to ever ride in the Breeders' Cup. That is such an honor. And how did that feel?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I mean, it was awesome. I mean, both that year, riding both of those races. I mean, it's every rider's dream to ride the Kentucky Derby, Triple Crown races, and to ride the Olympics, the horse racing, which is the Breeders' Cup. And I mean, it's, you know, it's a good feeling, you know, when things get down for myself, I go back and I think about those times. It's awesome. But, you know, I have to say that the difference between riding the Derby and the Breeders' Cup, I mean, the Breeders' Cup, no doubt, it's, you got the best horses in the world and the best jockeys in the world. But to ride the Kentucky Derby and you coming out of that tunnel, and, you know, I'm nervous and they start playing my old Kentucky horn. And it's an amazing feeling that I will never, ever get, you know. Hopefully I get a chance to ride the Derby again. But I mean, the first time, it's an awesome feeling. You have no idea, you know, to ride a race and the crowd and something that I watched on television and I'm actually doing this, you know, I couldn't believe it. I'm teared right now, and I've got the chills. It's an awesome feeling. I can't explain it. And then I didn't win. That was the Derby that Fusiaggi Pegasus won. But, you know, honestly, my horse made a bid. I was on a horse called Carew. I was a double entry with another horse called China Visit. Frankie Dettori was the rider. And I come out of the 19 hole, okay?
Wow.
And my horse broke fairly decent. Got going into the first turn, I was able to position myself like, you know, mid-pack or whatever, and all the howling and screaming. It's like a bush track race. I mean, you know, you got everybody howling and cussing each other out, but I'm trying to maintain position, and put your horse in a place to where, you know, you could win as far as what you looked at, as far as the pee-pees. And my horse made a turn for home. Well, going into the last turn, when my horse switched leads, and I smooshed at him a little bit, and poof, he got on the bridle, and I mean, I almost crapping myself because I'm like, I got a shot at him. You know, even though Fusiaggi Pegasus had been passes up on the backside and he was starting to open up, I mean, I still thought I would hit the board, and it was awesome. And my horse got tired. He, looking at the PPs, you could tell he probably might need a race or whatever, not. And he did get tired. And he ended up running seventh out of 19. And, but, I mean, which is good. But You know, I thought I would ride him in the next leg, and I didn't. I got Jerry Bailey's horse got scratched, and he saw that my horse had ran a good race, got tired, and I got bumped off by the leading rider in the nation at the time, Jerry Bailey, and didn't get to ride him, but he ran, ended up running dead last in the Preakness. So, and that was that.
Well, they
but the Breeders' Cup was an awesome feeling, too. It just it's not the same. I just can't. For me, anyways, and you know, through my experience of talking to other riders, it's like when me and Robbie talked about it, it's like the feeling you get, you know, the Kentucky Derby. Wow. You know, it's unbelievable.
That's such an awesome thing to hear. It gives me goosebumps to hear you tell that, Marlon. But do describe your ride in the Breeders' Cup.
Well, you know, my ride in the Breeders' Cup, it was a horse for Dallas Stewart. And Nasty Storm was a horse. His name was the Juvenile Fillies. And, you know, they thought she had a decent chance, even though the race was tough or whatever. But I went into the race with confidence, knowing that, I mean, you never know what can happen. You know, my horse had a lot of speed, and you know, we were hoping that she would finish or whatever. But I went to the lead you know, got the first call or whatever. And they ended up running by her. You know what I mean? She wasn't that caliber horse. They was, you know, I guess hoping, but, I mean, it was, you know, a privilege and an honor to ride it. And I really thank those people for giving me the opportunity. And it was good. But as far as the race, you know, I made the lead. And before the last turn, she was kind of fading away. And, you know, I ended up finishing. I maybe beat one or two horses. I really don't remember. But, I mean, it was a good feeling, but I didn't get the last, you know, that last quarter of a mile high of you know, getting a shot to win. But, I mean, I still rode the race, and it was an unbelievable experience.
Absolutely, Marlon. And let me ask you, you obviously made history, both of those races, the Breeders' Cup and the Kentucky Derby. Did you ever face, and I'm asking you this as a female in the sport, it was sometimes tough. There were people who would tell me, just outright, no, I don't ride girls. And that was the most frustrating thing in the world. Right. You just hope you beat them in the race. You hope you get them out and you can, you know, show them what made of.
There
but
you go.
Did you ever experience that as an African-American in the sport, which is nowadays rare? Before, back in the old days, it was very common. But these days, that's very rare. Did you experience difficulties with that?
You know, I honestly didn't. I'm not trying to sugarcoat the situation, but like in Louisiana, through me growing up or whatever, and there's a lot of prejudice down in the South, supposedly. But horse racing is, I think, a little bit different. I had one encounter, one situation that came up, and you know, I always looked at it as, you know, I had people on the outside, like, you know, like when I wanted to go to Kentucky. You didn't have to ride a black ride over there, blah, 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 and this and that. It's like trying to bring you down, you know. It's like, I'm not going to let that stop me. And I end up going, and when I started accomplishing things, those same people calling me and congratulating me. And, you know, some I answered, and some I just wouldn't even answer the phone because they were the ones that were trying to. But anyway, I had one encounter in Shreveport at Louisiana Downs. I'm real good friends with the Lonnie and Donnie Mesh. We were really tight at the time. And I remember Lonnie Mesh came up to me in the kitchen, and he was like really upset, and he had his helmet off, and I'm not going to say a name, but this one trainer was talking, and I guess my name came up, and you know, he's like, I wouldn't ride that if such and such a judge. And Lonnie went off on him. They pretty much got in a fight or whatever, and that's the only thing, you know. And you know what, after that, the next year, that was the first year I went to Shreveport. That following year, that same guy ended up riding me. He never knew that I knew that he did that and said that. That same guy rode me, and I ended up winning a handful of races for him. You know what I mean? It just goes to show you how ignorant people can be when it comes to, you know, your race or whatever. I mean, I think that's how it was in those days, and that's, you can't do anything about that, but I think that's the most ridiculous thing ever, you know.
Right.
It's crazy. You know what I mean? But
that's such a great story. You ended up riding for the guy and winning a bunch of races for him.
Yes, I did.
Just goes to show you that, you know, you're so talented that they couldn't stay away, and they had to bring you on board. And that's an awesome story, Marlon. That's a great thing that happened. Jockey Marlon St. Julien is joining me on Jock Talk tonight, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And Marlon, I want to talk briefly about the replay we just heard during the break. And that replay, it's a comparison to your Derby ride, Innovative Idea in the Grade 3 Groupie Doll Stakes. That was a horse owned by Godolphin Racing as well. So you wore the silks that you wore in the Derby, and that had to be a great feeling.
Well, it did. It was awesome to think about that. I was gonna, you know, I wasn't named on the horse. It was in my call. I guess I was in the selection of however many riders they went to, whatever. But I ended up picking up the horse, and you know, I had rode for Owen Hardy before, and for sure rode for Godolphin Stables with the Derby, and then, you know, after that in Chicago, I rode everything for him. But anyway, it was a good feeling to know that I was going to ride the horse. And looking at I knew she had a shot in the race, and I rode it with confidence, you know. John Court was the one that really named on the horse, and I was named on the horse for Mark Cassie in the race, and they scratched, and that's how I was opening. But my horse scratching made John Court have to ride, I think, a horse for Rusty Arnold or whoever he had gave his first call, you gave first call to. You understand what I mean? So when my horse scratched, John Court's horse scratched in that he gave first call to. So that left Owen Hardy's horse, which that was his second call. It wasn't his first call, open, you know, so they had to get another rider. So that's how I picked him up. You know, my horse scratching out of the race, I got upset, but then it was like a blessing in disguise because I ended up picking up John Court's mount because he had to ride another horse that I guess maybe they thought was better or he gave him the call before. So whatever the situation was, he had gave the call for that race to someone else, and the horse didn't get in the body of the race and got in after my horse scratched. So that's how I picked the horse up. And before the race, you know, studying the past performances or whatever, and I knew I had a shot, and I'm going to ride to win, and that's what I did. Things worked out fine, and then that's that, you know.
Worked out very well, Marlon. And describe the race to us.
Well, my horse, I knew she had a little bit of speed, and there was a couple other horses with speed, and we're coming out of that mile shoot, and when she broke forwardly placed, I was comfortable where I was. I sat behind the two lead horses, and I had a couple horses come around me. Probably about the quarter pole was when I really asked her to run, and I can't even remember the horse's name. And Michelle Lovell's horse, Sophie Dahl, was on the horse. I forgot her name. But anyway, when I kind of glanced into my shoulder, she was the only horse that was running out of the other two that I could glance and see that I thought would really be running at me. And she ended up coming on the inside of me, and I was able to kind of like intimidate her horse a little bit or whatever. Not because I saw her coming. You know, and it's a fine line that you got to do. You know, you have to stay in your lane or whatever. You can't come over or bump. You know what I'm talking about. But she came on the inside of me, and there was still a horse in the front of us, two horses in the front of us. And I was able to intimidate her horse a little bit. And after when I did that, I shot out, and, you know, while she was having to hesitate, I took off. And I ended up beating her. And she was the only horse running at the end, and I ended up beating her like a head or whatever. And she ended up claiming foul, which it wasn't good enough to take my horse down because I really didn't, you know, interfere in her path. I just got closer to her just enough to hopefully I would intimidate her initial run, you know, for the money, and it worked out like that, and that's what happened. So
worked out very well for you, Marlon.
Yes, it did.
I want to bring up something you mentioned earlier. You help out at Robbie Alvarado's farm, and we were actually scheduling the show today around the Shetland ponies who decided to founder on you, which I hope they're doing well.
Well, I don't know if they are. They just we're having problems with their hooves, and you know the guy ended up showing up here that we bought him from. That Robbie bought him from for his kids, and I forgot he was coming, so. And that's all that was, but I don't think they are. They're just in bad shape because it's so many different things you have to do. Those little horses, there's a certain amount you can feed them, and it's a lot of stuff that I'm not really educated in, you know. And I was just, you know, I didn't have to, but I was there, and I wanted to make sure everything got done right, you know. That's all.
Sure, and that's
and so,
that's.
But
that's...
he always, but he's always got something for me to do over here. You know what I mean? He tries to kill me. I'm joking.
What besides Shetland ponies? What other animals does he have at the farm?
Oh, we've got three other. Two retired racehorses, which his wife and one that they her family had and raised, and another horse, Stormy Socks. I think his name is. We call him Socks, but he a horse that Robbie won a bunch of races on for what's the guy's name? I forgot, but whoever trained him, Robbie, he liked him, and when they decided to retire him, Robbie wanted him, and they gave him to him. The owner gave it to him, and he's been having him at the farm, taking care of him, and we ride him every now and again. But that's it. And then we've got a paint, pretty much a Welch paint. She is, and that's it. We've got some chickens, and that's pretty much it.
Chickens and everything going on over there. What?
Oh yeah.
Do you have time to relax, to have fun over there whenever you're working at the farm all the time?
Well, yeah, no doubt. No, I mean, honestly, this is that's what I like to do. I'm a busybody. I don't like to sit down and watch television, or I'm always doing something. And this place is like, you know, Robbie's helped me out a lot in my career, but I mean, he has no idea how much he's helped me out now. But you know, me helping out here and this and that, it's just like relaxation. That's my relaxed time, to tell you the truth. I mean, I love to fix things, and, you know, if things go wrong with the tractor or the manure spray or whatever we got over here, the four-wheelers or dirt bikes, you know, I'm always tap welding something or just I stay busy, both of us. And he's got projects. He's redoing the apartment in the barn, and we both stay busy. You know, it's our little pastime, you know.
You guys are so close. How does that work on the track? I know, obviously, the jocks room, you know, that's the only locker room in a professional sport where all the riders gather together after competing against each other. So how does that work on the track? You guys are at the farm together.
No, we're like brothers. We're family off the track. But on the racetrack in the race, I mean, you know, we're aware of who each other is, but with it's like if I got a shot and you know I'm trying to beat him, it's like, you know, he's trying to beat me, and it's like, you know, he gets the same treatment as everybody else does in a race. If we're gonna shut each one of them, it doesn't matter. Like I'm gonna give an example. I was on a horse for Ryan Moquette Sunday. He was on a horse for Keith Bourgeois. I'm not good with horses' names. I can't. It's on the tip of my tongue. This horse that went in the Preakness or whatever, but anyway, he was dropping a lot, and I ended up getting him out for Ryan Moquette, and I had a shot, and I'm sitting like third, halfway down the backside, and Robbie's behind us, and his horse got in a bridle, and he kind of angled out and tried to come between me and the horse that's right in the front of him. He tried to go in between us, you know, and I had to shut him off, you know, and and that was that. And his horse got off the bridle. And I told him, I think I caused him to win the race, because he ended up, when he had to stand up and grab his horse looked like he came off with a bridle and relaxed behind us. And then when he punched at him at the quarter pole, he come around and he ended up beating me. I run second, he beat me. You know, I said, if I'd have just let you in there, maybe I'd be the winner, and then I'd have come back and beat you, you know. But anyway, yeah, but I mean, I shut him off. It's like he did the same to me. You know, we decided this a long time ago, you know, on the racetrack, look, we're not enemies, but, you know, it's not like, you know, I mean, if we got to do what we got to do to win the race. We're hired to do a certain thing, and that's to give the best of our ability as far as trying to win the race, and that's what I do. And if it means to shut Robbie off or Robbie shut Marlon off or whatever we got to do, we'll do it, you know. That's just how it is.
Right. It's a competitive sport, and obviously you have to worry about, you know, keeping everyone safe, not just Robbie, but everyone involved. It's, again, the jocks room, everyone's, you know, for the most part close until they go out to ride, and then it's, you know, it's a different story as far as competitiveness, but everyone watches out for each other.
You know, I talked about that little situation, but he's got me way more many times. He's got me a lot more than I've got him, so I don't feel bad. And then he ended up winning the race, but it is the fact that, you know, I shut him off, and the thought about it after the fact, but we come back and we laugh at that, you know. He'll tell me something like, what you doing knocking at that door? You knew you was at the wrong party. What you knocking the door for? You know, just joking like that. But, yeah, that's how it is.
Marlon, I tell
you. But, man, Robbie's been such a big, I mean, you have no idea, you know, and even in the beginning, like Shane Sellers, too, man. They both, like really helped me out a lot. Robbie, me and Robbie are like brothers. And when things got really bad for me, he was, like, there for me, like, big time, you know. And it's like I owe him my life, you know. I owe him to do good and to focus and to do, you know, the things that I'm supposed to do, you know, because he always reminds me of how, you know, the talent that I have and this and that. And he's such, like, I mean, he's been such a blessing for me. I can't explain it. So, I mean, things are starting to work out. I mean, I'm working hard and this and that, but, you know, it's like Robbie being, had a big part as far as that, you know, with that. And then seeing my kids, you know, I stayed in his house this winter, and I hadn't seen my kids in 4 years. You hear me? 4 years.
Wow.
And when him and his wife came back, they come back to Louisville for Christmas from the fairgrounds, and I was riding Turfway, and I stayed in his house, and they surprised me with my kids. Talk about the most, I mean, it was the best Christmas I ever had, you know. I hadn't seen my kids, and he surprised me with them. He's like, he's like an angel for me, you know. But anyway.
What a great story, Marlon. How many kids do you have?
I have three, two with my ex-wife and one with my youngest is with the girl I was engaged to back home in Louisiana, and it didn't work out with us. But yeah, my little girl is 17. I got a 14-year-old and then a 9-year-old, 8-year-old.
That's great. Any future jockeys there?
My youngest is small, but I don't think so. I hope not.
You hope not. Tell him to go to school, right?
Oh, yeah. Nowadays, the way technology is, you better all get up. Oh, yeah.
What, yeah. Marlon, what are your future goals as far as your career and what's next for you?
Well, I tell you what, if God blesses me with the ability and stay healthy, and if I could ride another 10 years, you know, because I got a lot of catching up to do, I think, and I mean, if I could just, and it, like I said, it's working out, and I could, if I could just get the confidence out of these people like I did before, and it's coming. I just want to get established here in Kentucky, make an honest living and live life happily ever after. That's you know, my plan. And you know, with being in the environment of high caliber horses or whatever, not you end up, you know, if I can do that for the next, you know, several years, the big races will come. You know what I mean? Because I know, I mean, I've got the talent to do so, and I know I can still get the job done. So, I mean, my goal is to just, you know, keep working hard and not move around. You know, that's another thing I did, bounce around a little bit, to stay here in Kentucky, maybe go elsewhere in the winter for the wintertime, maybe go to Tampa or go to New Orleans or Hot Springs. Or, you know, I'm entertaining the thought of all three of them, so I don't know yet. But and then come back here in Kentucky, and, you know, that's my plan. I want to be established here and go elsewhere in the wintertime and come back, you know, throughout the rest of the year. And
if
I could do that...
That's a great plan, Marlon. I can't believe it. We are all out of time. We could talk to you for 5 hours, Marlon. Wishing you all the best in your career. Thank you so much for joining us, Marlon.
No, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check it out on our website, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. You can also find a full schedule of every show on the Horse Racing Radio Network there. We bring you something new almost every day of the week. Again, check it out, horseracingradio.net. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.